American oil companies have a history of drilling in third world countries and not cleaning up after themselves. A new documentary called Crude was filmed in the Ecuadorian rainforest, where a group of indigenous people has been pitted against Chevron, one of the world's largest corporations. They've been fighting over whether residue from the production of oil has contaminated their region's water supply. But unfortunately for the plaintiffs, the unusual Ecuadorian legal system hasn't allowed for a speedy resolution, and the case has been pending for 16 years. We're joined now by filmmaker Joe Berlinger, who has made Crude, The Real Price of Oil, and by Stephen Dunziger, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in this case. Crude begins its run at the IFC Cinema tomorrow. That's at 323 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas, at West 3rd Street. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Berlinger back to our show and Steve Dunziger to our show for the first time. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us. It's always a pleasure.
Joe, I suspect most of our listeners aren't familiar with this case, so can you give us a brief summary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long and complicated case, but very briefly, Texaco Petroleum Company left Ecuador in 1992 after three decades of oil extraction in the Amazon rainforest of Ecuador. A lawsuit was quickly filed against them, filed in New York.
Now owned by Chevron?
Yeah, right. Texaco and Chevron merged in 2001, so Chevron inherited this lawsuit. So we'll be using Texaco and Chevron kind of interchangeably. But Texaco left the rainforest in 92. Their concession was not renewed by the government. A lawsuit was filed a year later in the United States. But the defendants in the case, Texaco, thought that this should be heard in Ecuador and spent a long, long time sending it to Ecuador. It got sent to Ecuador, refiled, and finally in 2003, the lawsuit kicked into gear. Shortly thereafter, I joined the party to document it. One of the reasons it has gone on for so long, I would not say, is because of the inefficiency of Ecuador, but rather the defendants have done everything they can to prolong the situation.
And the debate, to simplify it, Pablo Fajardo, the main Ecuadorian lawyer for the plaintiff, says Texaco dumped over a billion gallons of toxic water into the region, and the plaintiffs demand 100% remediation of the land. Sarah McMillan, Chevron's chief environmental scientist, says there's no link between the drilling of crude oil in the region and rates of cancer in nearby citizens. Stephen, let's bring you in here. Who are the plaintiffs?
Well, the plaintiffs are indigenous and farmer communities who live in Ecuador's Amazon. The indigenous groups have been there for millennia, and the farmer communities are more recent arrivals. But they're all impacted by living in an area about the size of Rhode Island that is highly contaminated with toxic waste. We estimate it's the equivalent of about 1,000 different Superfund sites in the United States, all in one area, with literally thousands of people living in and around the pollution, being exposed on a daily basis to oil hydrocarbons in their water, in their food, and animals that they hunt, and in the air that they breathe. It's really a horrific humanitarian catastrophe. Jim McGovern, who's a U.S. congressman, visited the area a few months ago and called it a humanitarian crisis, and he urged President Obama and the U.S. government to try to help alleviate the problem independent of the lawsuit. But the communities down there are banded together. I think the film is a fabulous portrayal of the struggle for justice, really led by the communities. I'm a lawyer, obviously. There's a bunch of Ecuadorian lawyers involved, and there's a whole group of communities and leadership down there that's fighting this and has been fighting it for years and years and
Steve,
fight it to the end.
Since this case is being tried in Ecuador, why are American lawyers involved?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is Chevron is an American company, and, you know, without some presence in America to deal with all of the public relations and legal and political things that Chevron is doing in the United States to undermine the trial in Ecuador, we wouldn't be able to play on a level playing field with them. And there's all sorts of legal issues involved that have to do with U.S. law, U.S. standards. As Joe mentioned, the case was initially filed in the U.S. federal court. Texaco and then Chevron agreed to abide by the jurisdiction of Ecuador's courts, as a condition of the case being moved to Ecuador. So the reason there's American lawyers is because this has really become a global battle, which I think is captured really well in the film. Even though it's being heard in Ecuador's courts, because it's an American company, there's battles taking place all over the place, in the U.S. Congress, in the media, and elsewhere, wherever Chevron chooses to fight. We have to show up and try to neutralize what we believe are their campaign of deceit and misinformation relating to what they really did down there.
My guests are Stephen Danziger, an attorney for the plaintiffs in the case that is the subject of Joe Berlinger's film called Crude, which opens tomorrow at the IFC at 323 Avenue of the Americas at West 3rd Street. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Joe, you say you got involved in this story fairly early?
Well, fairly late in the history of the case, but early enough to capture the most dramatic part of the situation, which was these field inspections, these judicial inspections of the actual pollution sites, where lawyers in jungle gear and media and people like myself trudged around the jungle for 2 years, standing in front of these massive pollution sites while the lawyers for each side argued their case. It was truly the most important part of the case because it was the evidence gathering phase, and from a dramatic standpoint, it was great cinematic material.
But it was still before most people outside of Ecuador were aware of
this case. I was stunned at how little. You know, when Stephen came knocking on my door in Manhattan, we have a mutual friend who introduced us, and Stephen started telling me about the case. You know, I did a quick search, was surprised at how little media attention it was getting. When I went down to visit the sites, I was stunned.
It's pretty called the Amazonian Chernobyl.
Yeah, I mean, I was embarrassed to be, if it were true that an American company had done this, I was embarrassed to be an American, regardless of what the legal wranglings are, you know, which I'm not smart enough to figure out. But just to the naked eye, this place is littered with unlined giant waste pits. For 30 years, they dumped toxic waste directly into the rivers and streams. It was mind-boggling what you saw down there.
Well, Stephen, does anybody deny that the water supplies in the region are contaminated?
Well, Chevron has tried to claim that whatever contamination exists is not due to oil, but due to poor personal hygiene of the indigenous people, which we find incredibly insulting. Chevron uses a whole host of junk science methods to try to distract attention from the core issues. No one disputes in the field of science that oil causes cancer and causes tremendous harm to human health, and there's no doubt that billions of gallons of oil and oil-related waters were dumped in this region over a period of many years, and they were done deliberately. You know, this is not like the Exxon Valdez. The Exxon Valdez, at least as bad as it was, at least was an accident. This was designed, a system that was designed to pollute by Texaco, and Chevron is now defending it, and it accomplished the result it was designed to accomplish. It basically polluted this entire beautiful area of the rainforest, causing tremendous harm to a lot of people. But Chevron claims they're not responsible.
Well, aren't they laying the blame on the Ecuadorian National Oil Company?
They're blaming PetroEcuador, which took over the fields from Texaco in 1992 and to some extent continued to operate them with the same poor production methods. But, you know, our point of view is Texaco designed the system to operate this way. They installed it. They exclusively operated it for 26 years. The case is about what Texaco did and the pollution Texaco left. There's no doubt that PetroEcuador also has caused pollution using Texaco's old system, but our legal theory is that Texaco is responsible not only for what it did, but for also what PetroEcuador has done using its system because they designed it to operate that way.
And, you know, Chevron uses the long delay in the trial to confuse people. The original lawsuit was filed right after they left or shortly after their departure. The pollution existed back then. It's complicated by the fact that PetroEcuador continued to use inferior methods, but that doesn't excuse the original system. And just to explain to listeners exactly what it is, because it's not as clear as it should be, when raw crude comes up from the ground, it's mixed with what's called formation water. Formation water has been mixed with the oil for millennia deep in the Earth's surface, you know, deep in the earth. When that oil comes up, the marketable crude and the heavy water are separated. The crude goes by pipeline to the coast and off to America for our SUVs, and this heavy water is supposed to be reinjected into the dormant cavities of inactive wells out of harm's way. Instead, it was literally piped into the rivers and streams that feed the Amazon River for three decades, and this is the home of, well, what was once six indigenous tribes, now it's five, because one tribe, the Tetete, are now extinct.
Now, the Pablo Fajardo, the main Ecuadorian attorney for the plaintiffs, is in many ways the star of the film. How soon after you started working on it did you connect with him?
You know, it's funny. I originally got kind of dragged kicking and screaming into this film. You know, when Stephen came to my office, I was impressed with the work he was doing, and he seemed like a great guy. But it wasn't clear to me that there was a film because he was telling me about this 13-year struggle. And I'm a cinema verite filmmaker who likes to film things as they unfold in the present tense, and I need some juicy characters to sink my teeth into and action to film, because I'm not somebody who makes films that are narrated and looking back at something. So we went down to the Amazon, and I was a little nervous about could I make a film out about this. But the moment I met Pablo and realized that these inspections were going to start taking place, I knew that we had kind of a great central character to sink our teeth into, because his story is incredible. Here's an impoverished oil field worker who is from the region, who lived in utter poverty, saw the...
Lives with his mother in a small shack.
Saw the indignities that his colleagues suffered, just felt like moved that he needed to do something about it, got himself educated, got a law degree, you know, got the Catholic church to pay for his education. And then lo and behold, I'm meeting this guy after, you know, he's had his law degree only for a couple of years, and now he's the lead attorney in this epic struggle against the fifth largest company in the world. I mean, just that stuff, regardless of the important cause that's behind this movie, but it's just good material for a film.
He's been portrayed in the media as the David in this David versus Goliath case. But how does he react to all the press? For instance, being awarded a CNN Heroes Award and being given a feature story in Vanity Fair.
Yeah, you know, the arc that he takes over the course of this movie is even I couldn't have predicted how extreme it would be. You know, I was just attracted to his heroism, to his, this authenticity that I haven't felt in a long time from somebody, just pure wanting to help people. But little did I obviously I couldn't predict that it would get the attention of Vanity Fair. That attention brought Sting's wife, Trudy Styler, down. That attention got Pablo introduced onto the world stage at Live Earth to a larger press audience. Sting himself presented Pablo to the press. That led to a CNN Hero Award. That led to this Goldman Environmental Prize, which is kind of the Oscar, the environmental equivalent of the Oscar. But he was all to answer your question. Anybody wouldn't be flattered by the attention, but I think it hasn't gone to his head. He cares about the mission. He's fighting for justice.
Well, would any of this be happening if Pablo Fajardo, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, wasn't also a good lawyer? How effective is he, Stephen? And how did you begin working with him on the case?
He's a great lawyer. He's just a natural. You know, I sort of compare it to, you know, you got a bunch of prominent Ecuadorian lawyers working on the case, and he was sort of the paralegal for a year or two. It's like a baseball team is having having trouble getting traction, and you ask the guy who's the bat boy to get up and take a couple swings, and they knock it out of the park, and you realize he's the best player out there, and he suddenly becomes the leader of the team. And that's pretty much what happened to us in Ecuador. Once Pablo took over the case, everything ran smoothly. Everyone respects him. Even the Chevron lawyers respect him. He is well liked. He's highly intelligent. He's savvy, and he knows how to get the job done. And he's really battling about eight or nine Chevron lawyers. He has a couple of younger lawyers who help him. But it's a very unequal situation in terms of resources. But Pablo's the only lawyer fighting the cases from the affected region. He was raised there, and his family is there, and none of the other lawyers on Chevron's side or our side are from the Amazon. So he's the only Amazon lawyer working on this case about the Amazon, and that's very powerful.
My guests are Stephen Danziger, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the case that is the basis for Joe Berlinger's new film called Crude, The Real Price of Oil. The film opens tomorrow at the IFC. That's at 6th Avenue at West 3rd Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Don't forget to check out our video section on our show page. You can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Frank Bruni on his lifelong struggle with his weight, Tom Ridge on his time as Secretary of Homeland Security, and Wallace Shawn talking about his essays. Just click on Video Picks. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from The New School, offering a graduate program in international affairs. Information session at 6 p.m. on Thursday, September 10th at 66 West 12th Street. More at 212-229-5630 or newschool.edu/international affairs. Battery Park City Conservancy, presenting Harmony on the Hudson, a free family music festival with live performances, games, art activities, and more, Sunday, September 13th, 1 to 6 p.m. in Robert F. Wagner Jr. Park. More at bpcparks.org.
WNYC is distributing a limited number of passes to a preview screening of the film Paris, co-starring Juliette Binoche and directed by Cedric Clapiche. Thursday, September 10th at 7, enter to win. Click on free stuff at WNYC.org.
Fans of YouTube call it a goldmine of creativity and democracy in action. Others argue it's ruining video production with low standards and mediocre content. Today, a soundcheck smackdown debate on YouTube and music. Plus, the winner of Soundcheck's video contest is announced. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. We're back with Joe Berlinger, the filmmaker whose latest is called Crude, The Real Price of Oil. It opens tomorrow at the IFC. Also with us is Stephen Danziger, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs involved in the story. Joe, as much as your film is about Chevron and the after effects of drilling for crude in third world countries, it's also about the Ecuadorian legal system. What are the judicial inspections where the judge, the lawyers from both sides visit the site of the alleged petroleum leakage? Why do they even have to do that?
Well, I think they wanted everyone to see the sites and to take samples and gather evidence. I was actually quite impressed at the thoroughness of the process. I mean, you occasionally in an American lawsuit see, field trips, but nothing like this. This was true. Hundreds of sites were inspected. Thousands of samples were taken. It was, a very exhaustive examination of the contamination, and boy, does it really hit home how messy the place is. It's incredible.
Is the legal system similar to the European system, where the judge is also the prosecutor? Stephen?
That's a good Stephen question.
It is similar to that. There's no jury trial, and the judge plays the leading role. And what's unusual about Ecuador is there's a law there that on big environmental trials, every 2 years, the judge has to rotate to the next president of the local court. So we've actually had four judges on this case.
So each one of them has to learn the case anew?
Not exactly. They're all down there and they substitute for each other. And, everybody's familiar with the case in the local court. There's only four judges on the entire court. And they all handle a lot of stuff and help each other, even though there's only one presiding over the case at any one time. But the judges down there are familiar with the case, and they rotate in and out of the case. And at the end of the day, the judge that has the case in his hands, when it becomes ripe for a decision, will make the decision. And at that point, the decision will then be reviewed by everybody in the local court as a first layer of the appeals process.
At one point, Chevron convinced a judge in Quito to sign an order for a judicial inspection of the independent labs that had been examining the contaminated sites. So the plaintiff's lawyers go down to speak with the judge and warn him not to be susceptible to the corrupt lawyers on the other side.
Yeah, it was a priceless moment that Stephen was involved in. Stephen, do you want to talk about that?
Because we see the opposing lawyers interrupting each other, bickering in front of the judge, in front of the cameras that are covering the whole thing. Is this kind of public spectacle common in Ecuador?
I don't know if it's common. I mean, this particular case, Chevron was playing very, very dirty and was trying to corrupt the trial process. You have to get in there and create a level of vigilance so the trial does not get corrupted by the party with the most money or the most to lose. And we felt like that was and frankly still is Chevron's tendency with this whole judicial process. So, you know, we battle them at every place they show up if we need to, you know, be it a court of law, an interview, the U.S. Congress, whatever it takes, we will fight them and fight them as hard as we possibly can, even though we're totally outnumbered and we have very modest resources compared to them.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen may disagree with this, but for me, one of the themes of the film, one of the larger things that I am observing, and of course it's an advocacy film for these people, but it also observes the advocacy movement, so in that way it kind of subverts the conventions of an advocacy film.
Although you do also give voice to the Chevron people.
Oh, absolutely.
Allow them to have their say.
Yeah, well, I thought that was extremely important. But what I was going to say here is that, you know, something that is taking this long, it's a 17-year struggle. If there's not an out-of-court settlement, it could take another 10 years. Meanwhile, generations of people continue to die and suffer. One of the things the film is observing is the inadequacy of the way the legal system is set up to resolve these large-scale humanitarian and environmental crises. Even the Exxon Valdez, which Stephen referenced, that was a clear-cut accident, and yet that judgment, the punitive phase of that judgment, was only paid off late last year, and at the 12th hour, Exxon got that judgment reduced by 80% as a final slap in the face.
Didn't the plaintiffs consider it a turning point when Rafael Correa, the self-described humanist Christian of the left, became the president of Ecuador?
I mean, it was
a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was a very important moment in the film, and I think a great moral triumph moment for the Ecuadorian people, because no president of Ecuador had ever visited the region until Correa. Now, Correa in this country gets a bad rap because he's written off as a left-wing protege of Chavez, anti-American, big business interests.
And well, has he done anything to speed up the case?
Well, you know, that's a very sensitive issue. As Stephen, I'm sure, will comment, and, you know, the executive branch and the judiciary branch, you know, are independent, and the executive branch of that country should not be getting involved in a lawsuit, just as they wouldn't get involved in this country. But they've shown their support. Now, Chevron has taken that support, that moral support, which simply meant he went to the region, visited the people, spoke out about the need to resolve this case. Chevron has taken that support as indicative that the process has become politicized and they're not getting a fair shake in Ecuador.
Stephen, one of the questions this film proposes is, how do you compensate indigenous groups for things that cannot be recovered, like the loss of their culture and the loss of their traditional lands? What, according to the plaintiffs, would be a fair settlement?
Well, I think there's a couple of levels of accountability. One is, even if certain compensations can't be given to make people whole, because a lot of the damage is irreversible. I mean, it's just no matter how much money you have to deal with it, it's never going to go back to what it was. But there's another level of accountability, which is that the perpetrator, and the perpetrator of what is essentially a human rights abuse, needs to be held accountable. And even if people cannot be made whole, the company needs to disgorge all the profits it made by abusing these people and using substandard operational practices, and also pay for as much of a cleanup as possible. And that's what we're shooting for. You know, companies can't go around and pollute the environment and pollute it so bad and then claim, well, we don't have to clean it up because there's nothing you can do about it at that point. I mean, that would be a recipe for disaster for the planet, and we've tolerated that kind of stuff too long in our society over recent decades. So, you know, we're trying to establish the principle that if you cause a problem, you have to disgorge every benefit you possibly got out of using these substandard operational practices that have caused so much harm. You know, the amount of damages that was assessed by the special master is $27 billion. And that's not a binding number. The judge can deviate from that, go down, assuming he finds Chevron liable, which hasn't happened yet. But that number is modest compared to the magnitude of the problem. And the reality is much of the impacts in the indigenous groups are never going to be able to be.
But doesn't Chevron argue that the plaintiffs and the lawyers aren't idealists, that they do stand to receive this enormous check if they win? $27 billion?
Well, the check wouldn't go to the lawyers. The check would go to a trust fund that would be used for a cleanup.
And you wouldn't get any? Don't lawyers always get a percentage?
Well, out of that amount, lawyers would get their legal fees plus some additional money to compensate them for the risk. But, you know, that's nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, without that kind of economic incentive, human rights lawyers like myself would never be able to attract financing to do cases like this. I mean, you know, there's just not a whole lot of money out there to sustain a legal case over 16 years against, you know, the third largest American company, unless there's some way you can make it economically viable for those who are financing the case. And that's a reality of contingency fee cases all over the United States and in many Western legal systems. And this is the same exact type of model. And, you know, that's important to establish. It's important to establish that lawyers can get their fees paid by fighting year after year after year if they get a recovery. But, you know, there's no guarantee we're going to win. And if we don't win, we don't get any recovery, yet we've spent 16-plus years, not to mention millions of dollars in expenses. So, you know, it's just the way it works in our society, and there might be a better way, but that's the way we have to do it, and there's no reason to run away from that.
Joe, this case has been going on for decades, as we've mentioned, and could go another 10 years. How has the Ecuadorian public viewed it over the years?
You know, it was fascinating. We had a screening at there's a Ecuadorian documentary film festival called EDOC that has played my films over the years. And then when they heard about this film, they wanted to make it the opening night film, which was, you know, I thought would be a very unique and special opportunity to play this movie in Quito, the capital of Ecuador. And in fact, they were anticipating such a large crowd that they reopened a university theater that had been closed for a decade to accommodate the number of people they were expecting to come. And we had about 1,400 people jammed into a 1,200-seat theater. The screening was probably the best screening I've ever had of any of my films anywhere, anytime, any place. But the one reaction afterwards from the regular kind of people in Quito, which is that they had never heard of this. They barely heard of it. So it was they were grateful and appreciative of the film and grateful and appreciative of the work that Stephen and Pablo are doing. But for some reason, this is just not, you know, clocked on the radar of many people.
Stephen, last week, Chevron said it had obtained video recordings of meetings in Ecuador that appear to reveal a bribery scheme, which appears to implicate Ecuadorian officials, including Juan Nunez, the judge overseeing the lawsuit, and possibly Pierina Correa, sister of the president of Ecuador. The recordings indicate that an Ecuadorian political operative was working to obtain $3 million in bribes. What do you make of all of that?
Well, it's unclear, and it needs to be investigated, including any role Chevron might have played in really designing what looks like a dirty tricks operation to try to undermine the trial. I mean, there's a long history of attempts by Chevron to delay and undermine the trial. This kind of thing fits squarely in that pattern, but it's unclear what role the judge had. We're happy he recused himself during the pendency of the investigation, and the most important thing is we don't think it's going to have much of an effect at all on the underlying trial. The evidence is in. 99% of the evidence was in under previous judges. I mentioned there were other judges who presided over the case. So it's probably not going to have much of an impact on the underlying trial, but it is obviously being used by Chevron for public relations purposes. Their entire strategy is to try to discredit Ecuador, the country, the courts. So when we get a judgment out of Ecuador in courts, if we indeed do get a judgment, they can then say it was not legitimate, and that's going to be their strategy on appeal and when we move for enforcement. So they're trying to contrive a bunch of issues, but we'll see what the investigation shows. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up backfiring against the company.
Joe, a portion of this film deals with the influence of celebrities on third world causes. And as you mentioned earlier, Trudy Styler, Sting's wife, the co-founder of the Rainforest Foundation, learns about the issue and then goes to Ecuador to see for herself. And that leads to Live Earth, or at least
Ecuador. An invitation to Live Earth.
And that's the first time that Pablo ever has left Ecuador?
Well, he had actually gone to San Francisco for another series of press interviews, but he didn't know who the police were and had never been to a rock concert. That was one of the humorous moments in the film. But, you know, the intersection of celebrity culture and social activism is one of the things the film observes. And
because they're often criticized for kind of parachuting into some big problem.
And I have tremendous respect for Trudy Styler and Sting, and they have been talking about the rainforest long before it was fashionable. Their foundation is over two decades old. They've done a lot of good. But the film does question why in our society does it take a celebrity attention and the attention of glossy magazines like Vanity Fair to kick something up into people's consciousness. I mean, this is a tragic story of indigenous people being forced into a Western lifestyle because we've taken away their means of sustenance. There's no fish in their river. The animal stock has been depleted in their forests. We force them into a Western lifestyle because we kind of rape and pillage the landscape. And then we abandon them.
Shouldn't we question why any of these stories don't get much attention? For example, there is a major oil spill right here in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint, larger than the Exxon Valdez, the largest oil spill in North America. And it's barely been mentioned in the press.
I agree. You know, I think it gives me a good pile of ideas to make movies about because the press doesn't cover a lot of these stories. But I am stunned at the level of injustice that exists around the world that we don't seem to talk about.
Now, Stephen, do you imagine this is going to go on for another 10 years?
Well, we have a plan to...
And you have to tell me very quickly. We have very little time.
It totally depends. Our plan is to get a judgment in force within a few months after it comes down, and their plan is to lay it as long as they can. It remains to be seen who will win that battle.
Stephen, Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky will be appearing at a special screening and discussion of their 1992 documentary, Brothers Keeper, tonight at 8 o'clock at the IFC Center. Their film, Crude, The Real Price of Oil, or your film.
My film, yeah.
opens at the IFC Center tomorrow. And it has been my great pleasure to speak to Joe Berlinger again and to Stephen Dunziger, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the case. It's been a real pleasure. And good luck, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again. I really appreciate it.
On tomorrow's show, Philip Seymour Hoffman joins director Peter Sellers to talk about the Public Theater's new production of Othello, then Juliette Binoche on her latest projects, a film called Paris, an exhibition of her paintings at the French Embassy, and her new dance performance at BAM. Plus, the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Abell, answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Miranda Schaefer, Adam Delahanty, and Stephanie Bernhardt. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.